Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 31, recorded November 9th, 2011. Daniel Kottke. Triangulation is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. And by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where Tom Merritt and I get together with somebody we think really is fascinating and pepper them with questions. And we've got somebody very interesting.
Somebody to pepper.
Yeah. Somebody to pepper. Daniel Kottke is, there's so many things to say with Daniel Kottke. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you. Welcome.
Old friend.
Tom Merritt.
Tom Merritt.
Okay,
yes. Yeah. Leo Laporte.
Leo Laporte.
And our vast listening audience.
And BB Twits.
And Twits. And a bunch of Twits.
Right.
Exactly. Daniel, I guess probably you're getting a lot of attention lately because you're mentioned quite a bit in the Walter Isaacson book about Steve Jobs. Have you read the book?
Not yet. Not yet.
You're going to?
Oh, I certainly will. I'm a little overtaxed with the whole Steve Jobs.
I bet you are.
Cultural.
So we should say Steve and Daniel were roommates at Reed. Is that right? And you had he talks about the acid room that you had.
Does he?
Yes, he does. Several times. You want to tell us about that? Because Steve very famously said that Bill Gates would have done a lot better if he just dropped acid once or twice.
You know what? See, I didn't know. I'd never heard that word. But I think I know what he's talking about. Uh-huh. I can tell you a story. That never came up because I... Now, this is very entertaining for me. Here's the story.
Okay.
It was our sophomore year.
Steve didn't... I thought he dropped out in a month.
He did.
So when you say our sophomore year, he was just hanging out.
He was hanging out.
But he stuck around.
Well, he took classes.
He took... And the professor said, go ahead, take classes.
The professors didn't really care. He had to get the dean's permission.
Reed was kind of a hippie. Still is. Kind of a hippie school.
Yes.
In fact, it's funny because... I would have been the class of 77 at Reed.
Are you kidding?
I got accepted at Reed.
That was my class.
Yeah.
We are the same age.
And I kick myself now for not going. I missed all the fun. I went to Yale instead for 2 years and said, this is it. I'm out of here.
Wow.
But I wish I had gone to Reed. I remember getting a certificate from Reed saying, you've been accepted. You can come to Reed. Because this was really a great, well-known school on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon, right?
Yes.
And had a hippie reputation, but also a very good liberal arts school reputation.
And I don't know how Steve ended up there. I ended up there because I had really good test scores, and I was the National Merit Scholar from my high school. And I thought I could go to Harvard if I wanted to. And I had gone to Cambridge because I had older friends who were at Boston University, and I loved Cambridge. I just wanted to go.
Wonderful.
I just wanted to hang out in Cambridge.
Great city, yeah.
And but I wasn't taken at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And so then I hadn't applied to enough places, and Reed had rolling admissions.
Right.
So in the spring of my year, someone pointed me to Reed, and it looked like an adventure. So
yeah, well, I think it probably was quite an adventure. So tell us about sophomore year.
It was our second year, and at that year I was sharing the dorm room with my girlfriend Elizabeth in the German house,
right?
Elizabeth Holmes.
Yeah.
And she's in Healdsburg. You could get her to come on the show.
We should. Elizabeth, come down right now.
She was Apple's first accountant.
Right.
So she would have a little story to tell about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was the German house. So it was only German-speaking people. She was in the German program. But it was an old wooden house. It had originally been a faculty house. So it wasn't the dorm. It was a really nice old wooden house. And... me being an explorer, it didn't take me long to find the hatch into the attic. So, and there was no ladder, but there was a window. And if you put your foot on the window ledge, you could climb into this attic. Okay. And it was a big attic, and it wasn't even that dirty. It was kind of nice up there. And so I tricked it out with India prints, and I made a little altar. We had incense burners, and it was just a nice spot.
A meditation room, really.
It was a meditation room.
Yeah.
And, you know, since you brought up the topic, I could believe that Steve went up there to take psychedelics. I mean, I would have invited him to go hang out there. Right.
Right.
And
it's interesting because he does. He talks about it in the book.
I believe. So what's funny is he never told me that, but I'm sure that story makes sense.
Isn't that interesting?
So yeah. That's the great thing about media.
Right.
It's like you learn parts of your own life that you never
know.
Knew.
That's
well, if it happened that the part of your life that was going on with somebody who became quite famous.
Yes.
And there was a huge amount of interest. What was your Well, there's so much to ask you about Steve Jobs. And I don't know. Do you not want to talk about it?
Oh, I'm happy to talk about it. You know, it's a complicated subject for me.
I understand.
But, you know, all of a sudden, so, you know, let's just say Steve and I had many years of a really good friendship.
You traveled to India together.
Yes. And freshman year of college, it's such a poignant and imprinting time
of
life.
Those people are
seminal
for,
friends
the rest for of life.
Yeah. Friends for life.
And I remember all my freshman
yes.
friends. Exactly. Yes.
I haven't kept in touch with one of them.
And yet.
You don't have any friends.
You know, and so then, but then, you know, 1980, Apple's heading into to the public offering, and Steve just cut me.
He cut me
off. He iced me. That's right. He iced me. And it was a hard thing.
They do
me.
Talk about that in the book. And Isaacson must have interviewed you.
Hours.
Yeah.
For hours.
Yeah.
2 hours, probably.
Because he talks about the fact that Jobs was, because the IPO was coming up, giving stock to all the employees. You were Apple employee number one, the first person to be paid
yes.
as an Apple employee.
Yes.
Apparently you were on vacation when they were handing out the...
Well, I was the first employee as part-time during the Apple partnership.
Right.
When it was Woz, Jobs, and...
whoever could, they could get to the garage assembling the boards, right?
Well, it was only me. There
was
no other employee.
I was the only employee.
How did they come up with employee 12 then?
Because I went back to finish my senior year of college.
Oh, okay.
At Columbia. And besides, at that point, it wasn't at all clear Apple would even survive.
Right. Right.
I mean, Apple was like a shaky house of cards built on the purchase order from the bite shops, which might not have even gotten paid. I mean,
right.
many companies never get past that stage.
Right.
And anyway, it's not like they had a formal human resources organization
that's
tracking
right.
all this.
That's
sense.
Right. Yeah. And so then, but it was, so I went back to Columbia to finish my senior year as a music major in 1976, fall of 76. Later that fall, Mike Markless shows up and looks at the two Steves and is not quite sure what to make of it, but he sees promise, and the rest is history.
Right, right.
And so then when I graduated from Columbia, I showed up to work full-time in June of 77, just in time to assemble the very first Apple IIs. So, like, the very first Apple II that went out the door, that was me turning the screws.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So the Apples you'd assembled in the garage were Apple Is, the original
yes,
Apples.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So then I was employee 12.
Yeah. Now, so just to finish the stock option or the stock story, it ended up Woz gave you stock.
Yes.
Jobs refused to give you stock. In fact, people came to Woz according to the book and said, I will match whatever you give Dan.
Yeah.
And Jobs said, good, because I'm going to give him zero.
Right.
What happened?
That was Rod Holt.
Rod Holt, that's right.
Who was my boss. And
the guy
who
designed the power supply, the genius, but he gets very little credit, the genius who designed the power supply for the Apple.
Yes.
Apple II, I guess, yeah.
Yes.
Switching power supply.
Yes, he doesn't get called a genius, but I think that's fair.
Yeah. But what happened? Why did Steve turn on you?
Oh, I really don't know.
You never know.
No, and the thing that's so poignant is I didn't even know that story till 10 years later.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, I didn't know.
Same thing happened with Woz and the Atari story. He
yes,
didn't hear
that's
about it
right.
Much later,
that's right.
And like Woz, I think you're similar in that sense. You're both
yes,
nice guys.
That's right.
And reluctant to say
that's right.
anything too mean.
That's right. And so, you know, I don't know. Out of deference to Steve,
yeah.
there's many things I wouldn't have said,
right.
if he was alive to hear them.
Right.
Anyway, so
that must have been hurtful, though. I mean,
well, it was very difficult in 1980, 81.
When there was a lot of... people were becoming millionaires.
Everyone I worked with became a millionaire. Yeah. Everyone.
And were they...
A few secretaries.
Were they just at higher levels or...
Well, I wasn't an engineer. I was a technician. And, you know, I looked at Woz and Jobs, and they were both college dropouts, right? And Steve Jobs was my peer in many ways. I didn't know electronics, but...
neither did he.
He knew a lot. He just didn't let on.
Really?
Steve, that was the thing I learned about Steve. He
knew more.
He was a poker player. You never knew how much he knew.
Oh, interesting.
From the very beginning.
Huh.
Did he ever explain to you? Did you ever ask why you weren't getting them? Were you ever given a justification?
Oh, I was never able to even ask him.
Yeah.
He would never talk to me.
Yeah.
Like from that, you know, by the summer of 1980, when Apple was headed towards the IPO, you know, there was no such thing as human resources.
Mm-hmm.
There was a payroll.
Right.
Nobody talked about stock options.
Right.
It was something that happened when you were hired. It never happened at any other time, pretty much. And because I was hired
early,
like I was there before, you know, I started as you know, in the garage, I was $3.25 an hour.
Right. Well, I want to rewind back to the college years. So it is good to tell that story because that's the story that you're known for. But I think that that's not the most important story that you
tell
about Steve Jobs.
It's not.
Tell us about the freshman Steve Jobs you met for the first time. What was he like?
He was quiet. He was, I wouldn't quite say introverted, but I met him because Lawrence Phillips was in his dorm. He was not in the same dorm as me, so I would have met him eventually.
Right.
But we met in like the second or third week of school because I had met Lawrence the first day because we were both tall, skinny, long-haired kids from New York with wire-rimmed glasses. So we just bonded right away.
Like attracts like.
Yeah. Yes. And Lawrence said, "You should come to my dorm and meet this guy, Steve. He's interesting."
Interesting how? I mean, what was it that Lawrence was seeing? That he wasn't another freshman?
It wasn't so clear, actually. But that first day I went over and met Steve, he had this big TIAC reel-to-reel tape deck, a piece of professional gear with the big 7-inch reels. And it was filled with all this bootleg Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Which didn't really interest me, but it was an expensive piece of gear for a freshman, especially a freshman who dropped out over having no money.
Right.
Of course.
So, time immemorial, college students have been pirating music. I mean,
that's right. It wasn't unusual that he had the bootlegs,
right.
But it was an expensive piece of gear.
Yeah.
Right. And so he had taste in good gear, even
already.
Like right on.
Yeah.
But my friendship with Steve developed because in the next couple weeks, Be Here Now came to the Reed College bookstore.
Ram Dass's book.
Yes, mm-hmm. And it was a very unusual book. And it was $3.33, so I could afford it, unlike many books, right? And Steve and I both happened to just buy it the same week. And I wanted somebody to talk to about it because I had never seen anything like this. And it was, spirituality miracle stories that were fresh.
Ram Dass was a Harvard professor, Richard Alpert.
Yes.
Who dropped acid, got turned on to Indian mysticism and religion, and wrote this amazing book, which in my generation, our generation, was a Bible for many of us.
Yes, it was. And so that book is what started our friendship, really. And I can remember going around and asking people, well, this is quite remarkable. What are the names of other books like this?
Right.
And the very next one that we got
Watts?
No, close. That was in the top five.
Okay.
But the very next one was Autobiography of a Yogi. And they had that in the Reed College bookstore.
Yeah.
And so Steve and I both read those at the same time. And then the third one was Ramakrishna and his devotees and his disciples.
You know, it's interesting. Walter Isaacson says he asked Steve Jobs to see his iPad shortly before he died and what books were on there. And one of them was Autobiography of a Yogi.
Yes.
Which Jobs said he'd read every year since that first year that you...
Now, that actually really surprised me. Why? Because... you know, when you read Autobiography of a Yogi, the whole book is kind of rosy tinted. it's lush and spiritual and miracle stories, right? And Steve is a little more cynical than that. Really, he is. He's more cynical than I was, mm-hmm. back then at least. Mm-hmm. And I think from 40 years perspective now, I look at those stories and I think, well, that's interesting, but I don't believe
it's
any of those.
It's fairy tales.
Although the sentiment and the spirituality is perfectly genuine.
Maybe he liked the inspiration.
Yes,
that pulled that counterweight to his personality.
Yes, and that. So Muktananda was a follower of Yogananda, and Muktananda had an ashram in the Bay Area. And I remember Steve telling me years later that he was so disappointed. He had gone to some retreat ashram with Muktananda and sat outside his tent all night to get his meeting with the yogi and failed. Like, never met Muktananda. Hmm. Anyway.
When did you decide to go to India together? Was that his plan?
It was enabled because Steve had left Apple, or he had left Reed to go back to the Bay Area, and he got himself hired at Atari.
Atari, yeah.
And
they tell this story. Now, you have to corroborate this or not. Steve was barefoot, long-haired, and believed because of his fruitarian diet that he had no body odor at all. Very famously, they said, you have to work the night shift because
no one else agreed.
We do not agree.
Yeah.
I never heard that.
Would you agree?
Well, I don't think Steve... I spent a lot of time with him. I slept in his bedroom when he would sleep on the couch sometimes. Mm-hmm. And there was never... a body odor issue.
All right. So we correct that record.
Yes. And in fact, I'm not sure that I ever saw him turn orange from eating so many carrots.
That was another story. Yeah.
However, carrots was his number one favorite food.
Yeah.
And so that's what I say is the Apple One, that whole summer of the Apple One was fueled by carrot juice, raw carrot salad, dates, and almonds. That was our diet.
Mm-hmm. You too.
Oh, yeah. And cherries. And 1975 is when Steve found this book called The Mucusless Diet Healing System,
right,
by Arnold Arendt. And then the companion book was called Rational Fasting by Arnold Arendt from the 20s about curing cancer. It's a very poignant story. Curing cancer through fasting.
He never lost that fascination with odd diet and, his whole life he continued
that. But odd's not the right word. We're talking the natural human diet.
Mm-hmm. So you agree with it? You think it's an appropriate diet? Do you still eat that way?
No.
It seemed to me he almost had an eating disorder. Like, he was like a little obsessive.
I wouldn't say so at all.
No, I wouldn't say that at all.
No.
This is why I love talking to you, because when you read a book like this and you read all these anecdotes, they become larger than life and I think become somewhat fairy
tales. So here's what I'll say for the record. From my point of view, being right there, because I was actually...
You were eating the same
completely
food.
...completely agreeing with Steve.
Yeah.
I didn't agree with the whole mucus being the root of all disease. That's what Arnold Arendt said.
Right.
Right? Although, it's not a far leap from there to when you talk about wheat... and dairy.
Right. That's what people talk about.
Many people have, right, like 30% of the population has either wheat or dairy intolerance, which causes all kinds of health problems, mm-hmm, that can cascade and cause other problems. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Arnold Arendt was an interesting guy, clearly. And he had Bright's disease for decades and had gone, which is a nervous system disorder. Goes by a different name now. I don't even know what it's called. You can look it up. Bright's disease.
I'm sure the chat room will tell.
Anyway, he had gone. The true story here is that he had gone to dozens of doctors, and he was wealthy from a wealthy family, and so he had money to spend on doctors, and nobody could fix him.
Nephritis. Okay? Acute nephritis.
Well, nephritis just means...
That's a kidney issue.
Right? Kidney inflammation. Yeah. Okay, so it's a kidney disease.
Sounds like Bright's disease was kind of like consumption. It was a catch-all for kidney diseases.
Maybe. Now, anyway, the story of Arnold Arendt was, after decades of being ill through his adult life, someone set him on a fast, and it was a miracle for him, For him, it was the first time he had been healthy. And that just fired him up. And he decided that, you know, cherries and grapes, that was his ideal human food. And kind of like, well, you know, when we were freshmen, Steve and I had both read Zen Macrobiotics, mm-hmm. which is also a very persuasive story.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's interesting. And George Osawa then died of cancer. So, you know, but anyway, to go back to the word oddball, right? It's not fair to talk about oddball diet. What we're talking about is a theory about the principles of human health. That's what interested Steve and me both. It's the theory that interested us.
Did he have an engineer's mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was systems interested
yeah.
him.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And yet, I mean, I think he will be remembered as a product person, as an artist in product. Yeah. Was that there also? You said the TIAC was this beautiful thing.
Yes.
He liked products even then.
We were both poor and we not like we had we were buying anything.
Right.
But you know, Steve really took to the calligraphy class at Reed.
He tells that story,
did I.
Yeah.
And I didn't know till years later that he considered it his most influential Reed class, because that's what I said too.
No kidding.
I said it was because it was unusual.
Right.
It was I don't know. I was a nerdy guy, not interested. I was a math major at Reed, mm-hmm. and losing interest in math, and hadn't discovered electronics. And I latched onto Eastern literature, and that was my passion. But calligraphy was very interesting also.
It seems like the theme here is finding ignored or unobserved truths in sort of less explored areas is what's fascinating here.
Yes.
Things like the calligraphy and the and the yoga.
I want to talk
That's what school's for, really.
That's
right?
It. You discover stuff. Yeah,
yes.
That's the whole point. I want to talk about your indie experience in just a moment.
Okay.
And a lot more. Daniel Kottke is here. He still hosts a show on technology.
Still,
for how many years have you been doing?
No, it's not technology. It's a show on consciousness.
I'm sorry. It's called The Next Step.
The Next Step.
Of consciousness.
Here's the tag. The tagline for the show is The Next Step, showcasing the art, music, literature, spirituality, and politics of the evolving new consciousness.
I want to see this show.
well,
you can see the URL right there, tns-cableshow.blogspot.com, and there's the website.
And that's theoretically where the there will be links when I get my act together. The links to the Blip TV will be on there.
So you start doing video. Well, you are doing video because it's access show, but it's a question of getting
Uploaded several shows to Blip TV, and you cannot find them if you search.
We'll help you
because the
that.
Blip TV search engine is not really...
Steve Wolf. Call on Steve Wolf. We'll get Steve on that one. We do want to take a break and talk a little bit about one of our sponsors, Audible.com. And actually, this is very timely, because that's how I read the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson. I've listened to it on Audible. Audible's great for that kind of thing, because who has time these days to read? I wonder if they have Be Here Now. That would be... The thing is, there were a lot of drawings in Be Here Now. So I wonder, that would be... Are you pulling out your audio?
I'm turning my phone off.
Oh, okay. I thought Daniel was pulling out his audiobook. Audible.com. Go there right now and take a look at the 100,000 audio titles there. If you haven't read the Steve Jobs biography, this is a great opportunity to do that, because you can get it free by going to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. I apologize for all the length on that, but that's the URL, audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. You'll be signing up for the gold account. That's a book a month. First month's free, first book's free. Yours to keep, cancel at any time. You don't have to pay a penny. And this would be, I mean, if you haven't read this, this is a great book. But there are so many choices, 100,000 wonderful choices. And if you're interested in consciousness, lots of great stuff there as well. Fiction, nonfiction, youth and children's books. It's just an amazing collection, really an audio library.
I'm listening to Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman right now, which is the BBC radio version. He was a Soviet author who was suppressed.
Never heard of it.
Fantastic book. It all takes place during Stalingrad.
Wow. I've just downloaded 1Q84, which is...
Oh, yeah. That's my next on my list.
Huge book. But yeah. It's supposed to be very, very
1Q84.
Good. 1Q84. It's kind of a dystopian, futuristic book that takes place in 1984. So
right.
I don't...
But it's kind of an alternate 1984.
Alternate. Yeah.
Right.
I can't wait to read it. Anyway, great stuff. Pick your book. There it is. Haruki Murakami. Check it out. Great stuff. 46 hours. That'll keep you busy.
That's why it's our alternate pick in our book.
Wow.
But it's yours free, audiblepodcast.com/triangulation.
That's longer than Gravity's Rainbow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Another great book.
And Murakami is...
Durantia book. Yeah. Who said that?
Oh, I have
That's
that.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Durantia. I forgot about that.
I have a copy of that.
I don't think Steve knew about the Durantia book as far as I...
The Kingdom of the
It came up after we had kind of parted
our
ways.
I feel like because... I feel like if I could have only got to know Steve, we would have gotten along because we have that... We come from that age cohort. Our generation was a little unique in our interests and our... So... You went to India. Did you go together? Steve went first, right?
Oh, you were starting to ask about how it came about.
Yeah.
And I was saying it was because he got the job at Atari. So he had money. Okay.
Not a lot of money. But
not
he had
a lot,
some
but
money.
He had spending money.
Yeah.
And then the next item was that Robert Friedland was the student body president at Reed.
He's the guy who owned the Apple Orchard, right? Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Called All One Farm.
Right.
It's called All One. It was a commune, hippie commune, back to the land farm.
You and Steve lived there for a while. Elizabeth lived there.
Yes.
Steve pruned the trees one summer, and it said that that was a seminal experience for him, that he learned that you cut back all the extra limbs so that the few limbs that remain can thrive. It said that's what he did at Apple when he returned to Apple.
And... Oh, that's a good image.
Isn't
I like
it?
That.
Yeah, it
yes.
Is. Yeah.
So it was 1974 we had gone to India. 1975, I came back to California.
You and Robert went to India in 74.
No, Steve Jobs and I went to India in 74.
He got very sick, didn't he? When he got there, he got dysentery for months, I think.
I might have been sicker.
Really?
Yeah. I was sick the whole time.
Oh, my God.
But it was a low grade. I mean, it was just diarrhea.
Right. Like, you just kind of
who cares?
Not feeling great.
I don't know. You're squatting over a hole in the ground anyway. It's like...
It's just part of the experience.
Yeah, it's part of the whole experience.
Yeah.
Anyway, the way the trip came about is we found out that Robert Friedland was actually in the Be Here Now book, part of that scene.
Oh,
okay. That is to say, there were pictures of him... Maybe not actually in the book, but taken that same time.
Right.
So he was part of that milieu.
Right.
And so he's the one who put us up to the trip. He said, you know, he fixed us up with contacts, told us where to go and stay.
He said, go east, young man.
Yes. And it happened to be the year of the Kumbh Mela.
What was that?
Kumbh Mela is the biggest religious gathering on the planet.
Wow.
And even back then, it was 10 million people. In recent years, it's 20 million people.
Wow.
And the Maha Kumbh Mela is once every 12 years. It was at Hardware Rishikesh in 1974, in the summer of 74. And that seemed like a perfectly good excuse to go rushing off to India.
Is it a Hindu-oriented thing?
Yeah.
It's the
fakirs, the yogis.
Yeah. Do you think Steve went for spiritual?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Enlightenment. You were seeking enlightenment.
We were, what we were really seeking is to understand what we were reading about in our books.
Right.
Okay, so...
Go to the root experience.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to know if these miracle stories are really happening, because you just read something in a book, who knows? And Steve and I both read Carlos Castaneda the same year. And you read Carlos Castaneda and you think, okay, is this real?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds real. Like, maybe it could be real. If it's real, that's very interesting, right? So if we had known where to go look up Carlos Castaneda,
right.
we would have done that too,
right.
I guess. But anyway,
the Yaki sorcerer.
You have to go to another world to do that.
Anyway, so that was how that trip came about. Steve, I mean, so this was 70, I guess, 74. I guess we were in phone contact. You know, he had gone back down to the Bay Area, but...
Was he a real persuasive guy at that point?
No, not at all.
That came later.
But he was...
Was there a reality distortion field?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah.
But he was thoughtful and intense.
And bright.
And bright. And that's a good combination of qualities, and that's why I was attracted to him.
Sure.
And, you know, I was the same way I'd like to think. But
anyway,
we had many long happy hours discussing books and life.
Right.
And, you know, as poor students, every Sunday night we used to hitchhike to the Hare Krishna temple because it was the love feast.
Free vegetarian meal.
Yeah, and it was really good food.
Yeah.
And so that's how we both developed a taste for Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, in particular, had a good rapport with the guy who was the head of the Portland Hare Krishna temple. And I can't remember his name, but he was about the same age as us. And he was a full-on devotee, you know, with his little symbols. And he was a very personable guy. And anyway.
I have to think that people listening who are not of our generation must think this was the strangest generation. This generation was fascinated by these arcane. I don't know. Tell me.
I don't think so. I think what you know, and I'm not that much farther behind you, but you know, I graduated high school in '88, and so you know, it's like
a
decade later. And our perspective is that this stuff became stereotypes. So what was fascinating and a discovery...
It was old hat to
in
you.
The 60s and the mid-70s.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're probably
for us,
right.
Hare Krishna is
That's
a
fair.
Joke in airplane.
Right.
I agree.
You know?
Yes.
And so and so our discoveries are in totally different areas. In fact, when they brought up the Urantia book, I was like, yeah, that's more closer to my age. Our age is the Church of the Subgenius and Principia Discordia and all that sort of reacting and kind of an ironic take on all of this stuff.
Yeah, you were the ironic generation.
Yeah, that's right.
We were the wide-eyed. We just missed the 60s. We just
that's
missed...
That's exactly right.
The Summer of Love.
I was 1 year too young to go to Woodstock.
Precisely.
Yes.
I remember lying in my bed in Providence, Rhode Island, listening, and they're saying, they're all the kids are going up to New York State. And like, I think what we were 13 or 14.
I was 15.
15. And just
young.
A little too young.
Yep.
But would have loved to have gone, but we're and so we came a little after, and I think we're trying to catch up.
Yes,
to
and
Timothy
that's
Leary
kind of,
and
that's
company.
What the Kumbh Mela represented for me.
Sure, it was the Woodstock.
Yes. But all of this stuff persists in college, and I think it still persists in college. This idea of like autobiography of a yogi and reading and discovering
well, and
all this
it should.
Stuff because new generations are always
should,
discovering
right.
it for the first time.
Well, I had read Siddhartha in high school. I was a huge fan of Hermann Hesse, and so.
And that's the story of the young Buddha.
Yeah, Siddhartha's
wonderful book,
hugely wonderful book.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's see. Did we finish the topic of how we got to India?
So you got to India. Yeah, we kind of got there. Did you
had the
get
diarrhea?
To the,
you got the free vegetarian food.
Did you get to the what was it? The Mahar?
The Kumbh Mela.
The Kumbh Mela.
Well, I wasn't going to blow off my final exams,
And
Steve was impatient to go.
Yeah.
So he arrived 10 days before me. And I don't know who he hooked up with, although the guy's name came back to me, Nahar Singh. He was a French hippie.
Nahar Singh,
You're nodding like you've heard of him. He's just some guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know why his name popped into my head.
It sounds familiar.
Steve had met him somewhere in New Delhi.
Yeah.
And Nahar, you know, and Steve just like hitched, like, we're going to the Kumbh Mela. So Steve Steve jumped in the car and they went.
Awesome.
And then Steve got sick and immediately hitchhiked back. Okay. And I met Nahar later in the summer. And in fact, Nahar was the guy who shaved my head for the first time.
Wow.
With no soap. That's the way they do it in India. It's a straight razor. They take a little olive oil, they rub it into the scalp, and then it's scary. And there's blood involved.
Did it hurt, though?
It didn't hurt.
No.
Anyway, so we got to the Neem Karoli Ashram, Neem Karoli Maharaji from Be Here Now.
Right.
And it was deserted. So that was kind of a letdown. We didn't really know what to expect. Neem Karoli had passed away 6 months earlier. Even though there was a huge scene around him, all Western hippie types, Europeans, Westerners, once Neem Karoli was gone, the local Indians did not want all these foreigners mooching, because really a lot of them were just penniless.
Right.
And so, jow.
Get out of here.
Jow. That's the word they used.
Call.
Anyway.
Get off my ashram.
Anyway, so that was just kind of a quiet, it was just not much going on.
Right.
And so Steve and I just kind of traveled around. We took the bus. We went here. We went there. We went to other ashrams.
He said that if Bill Gates had dropped acid and gone to India for a year, he would have been. I think it was Bill Gates he was talking.
Yeah,
about.
Yes.
He would have been a little more with it. You think that's the case?
Well,
not about Bill Gates, but that was a seminal, obviously seminal for Steve Jobs.
Yes,
that formed his character.
Yes, and me too. And and I think Steve probably did say that.
Yeah.
I never heard him say that. But
sounds right. Though.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
And Well, you know, Jobs and Gates, there's another pair for the ages.
Yeah, no kidding. So did you ever talk to Steve after this, after you left Apple? Did you ever get to talk to him or run into him?
He and I didn't talk for 18 years, from 1982.
Over this stock issue?
No. Well, the stock issue wasn't even an issue because he would never even talk to me about it.
Right.
So I was just in this limbo state.
Right.
I actually decided I should leave Apple and go work somewhere else and feel better, right?
You feeling unappreciated because of that, or because of a lot of things?
The policy at Apple, which you don't blame Apple for, was only engineers get a stock option.
Mm-hmm.
Technicians generally don't get stock options anywhere. Okay,
right? You just
so secretaries
no reason usually, to get an exception.
That's right. And, I was just in a weird situation there.
So what made you want to move on?
Well, I learned the first year that I had an aptitude for electronics, and I was quite good at it, if I might say so. I was very good at fixing Apple IIs, and at that point I knew I would be a good engineer, but I had a few years to catch up. And unfortunately, Apple was a train that was picking up speed, and I could not run fast enough, right? And so... I didn't even know the issue about that I wasn't eligible for stock because I wasn't an engineer, but I knew I wanted to be an engineer, and nobody at Apple was going to make me an engineer, and it was just difficult for that reason.
So you didn't talk to Steve till the 90s?
The 2000s.
Did you run into him? How did you?
No, I really didn't run into him.
Yeah.
When you ended up talking to him again, how did that come about?
It was the Albert Hoffman LSD letter.
He's the inventor of LSD.
Yes, Albert Hoffman. At the time, Albert Hoffman was 101 years old.
Yep.
Because Steve had been vocal about LSD being a positive factor in his creative development. That's a good way to put it, right? I think it was Rick Doblin, founder of MAPS, who had the idea to approach Albert Hoffman to get Albert Hoffman to write a letter to Steve Jobs asking for financial support for LSD research, which had just become legal.
Hmm.
Just become legal now.
So Hoffman was still an advocate.
Oh, yeah, sure. Hmm. I mean, that's a whole amazing story.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the letter was written, and I heard about it somehow. Well, Rick was a friend of mine, but I didn't hear about it. I just heard about it somewhere. And I volunteered to deliver it, thinking that Steve might appreciate this.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think Steve would be honored to get this letter. And I thought maybe it will help repair our relationship. Well, not really, but anyway, I did make the introduction between Rick and Steve, and there were conversations. I think if Steve had given any money, we would have heard about it by now. But... anyway,
Steve was not famous for giving money to anybody.
Anyway, it was a month or two after that, I got a phone call at 7 in the morning when I was sound asleep, and it's Steve calling to chat, which was a huge surprise, and we had a nice chat. And the tone of it was, we'll have to get together again and talk about old times. So I thought that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Never did.
Well, it's too bad.
Was he already sick then? Was that what was going on?
Well, 2009, he'd already had his liver transplant.
Yes.
It was when he was feeling mortal, for sure.
I think he was doing a lot of that. I think that he talked to a lot of people.
About
the old days.
I'm grateful for that. But he and I never actually had our discussion about the old days, which makes me sad.
What would you have told him?
Well, we had many good times together, and that's all.
Yeah.
That's all. It's just, high school, college reunion kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and then what happened this year was it was the Reed Centennial this past summer. And biggest party in the history of Reed College. There was 2,500 people on campus, including lots from our class. And Steve was too ill to go.
Yeah.
Or wouldn't have gone anyway, probably. But I gave him a write up. I mean, I gave him a detailed write up of all the people he would wanted to hear about, and I really thought I would get a thank you, but No.
He might have been Reed's most famous graduate.
Probably,
well,
yes.
Graduate.
Yes.
Or attendee.
Yes,
alumnus.
Probably.
Matricula.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Gary Snyder.
Gary Snyder, the poet. Yeah. There were a few. Yeah. Daniel Kottke, I think he went there.
Did all right.
So the Steve Jobs that you read about and hear about, when you read the book, I'll be very curious what you think. Does that jibe with the Steve Jobs that you knew as a kid? Really, I mean, really, he was a kid when you knew him. He was 18, 19.
Well, what I say is his personality went made the big change in about 76, 77.
So you actually were there. You saw it.
Yeah. And it definitely wasn't about money. There was no money.
Right.
It was more about the opportunity to change the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fair to say that I didn't actually understand the technology well enough to really have a view of what we were doing. But it was clearly unusual, and unusual enough that if it succeeded in a business sense, there were many positive business opportunities.
But it wasn't the business opportunity that he was most interested in.
Well, I would say it was the... Yeah, actually, I think you're right. It was, well, I think it was both.
Woz tells the story that every time every time I'd invent something, a Blue Box or Apple One, Steve would say, we can make a business out of this.
Right.
So he certainly was aware
of
the idea.
That's right. Now, so.
But that may not have been driving him.
You know, Chris Ann said once, like many, many years later, like in this millennium, she said, oh, yeah, Steve told me in high school that he would be rich and famous.
Yeah.
And I was amazed to hear that. I never saw that in him. Yeah. I never saw that he had a burning ambition.
Yeah.
He kept it very well hidden.
Sounds like he kept a lot hidden.
Yes, he did. You know, when I knew him at Reed, we were best friends at Reed.
Right.
He had other friends, but I was probably his closest friend, and not one word about Blue Boxes. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Huh. Well, the Blue Box was pretty much over by the time he was at Reed. The Blue Boxing was in 1971.
But he didn't even talk about electronics.
No, he didn't talk about electronics at all. And you know, and then when we were in India, Steve just took off for 2 days, like on his personal vision quest. And I found out later he had gone to visit Lama Govinda, who's a famous author, who I would have wanted to go and meet, but it was a secret thing for Steve.
He was very private.
He was very private in that way.
Do you see that in his in the products that he had influence on? They're very protected. They're very private.
Things.
Yeah,
Apple's corporate privacy policy.
That's a reflection of his personality,
that's right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
We're talking with Daniel Kottke. I want to talk about what you're up to, because it shouldn't just all be about Steve. So when we come back, what you're doing.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
No, well, you know, I know you know everybody wants to know about Steve. That's got to get tiring after a while.
Well, there is a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
I would have to say that, you know, I've been, like, solidly booked in interviews for a month now.
Wow.
A month. And no one asks me what I'm doing now.
Well, good. Let's be the first. How about that? But first, a word from Ford Motor Cars. We're really happy to have Ford as sponsor Triangulation. They are absolutely the 21st century car company. You could check it out if you go to Ford.com/technology and look at some of the amazing things they're doing. There's the site with their electric vehicles. I'm very excited that electric Ford Focus is coming out finally. I've been waiting. I'm on the list. The plug-in hybrids, even the gas engines, the efficiency, the fuel efficiency, and yet performance that they've been able to eke out of these engines. It's amazing. But it's not just the engines. It's inside the car, too. Of course, the Ford Sync, we've talked a lot about that. I've been talking to my car a lot longer than I've been talking to my iPhone. I could tell Sync what temperature to set the cabin. I could tell Sync what song to play. I could tell it, find me a gas station, stat. And now, with AppLink, Sync can talk to your phone. AppLink is an API for smartphones. Works with iPhones, Android phones, and the latest BlackBerry OS. Things like voice control Pandora in your car. It's awesome. You can actually
have your Twitter feed read, dude.
You can, OpenBeak will read you your Twitter feed. With Pandora, you could say PlayStation classic rock, and it'll play your classic rock station. You say, bookmark that song. I want to buy that. Or thumbs up, thumbs down. The point is that you want to be able to interact with this stuff without taking your eyes off the road or your hands off the wheel, so it's safe. And yet you're really not disconnected from the world anymore when you get in that car. Sync AppLink is built on the an API platform that means that others in the app community can continue to develop for Ford cars. So lots more stuff's coming along down the line. The AppLink is available in the 2012 Ford Fiesta. And of course, the My Ford Touch, very cool stuff. You know, did you see that they're sending out, they're going to update Touch. And the way they're going to do it, 250,000 people have My Ford Touch. They're going to send them all USB keys.
That's easy.
You get in your car, plug the USB key, updated the car. Amazing stuff. Ford.com/technology to learn more, or better yet, go to your local Ford dealer and take a test drive. These cars are literally the state of the art, and we're really proud to have Ford as a sponsor of our show. Ford.com/technology. So you're doing the TV show. What else are you up to, Dan?
Wait, I have to answer this question that made me laugh.
In the chat room.
Someone on the chat room asks if Steve practiced his famous stare on me.
Oh, yeah.
That cracked me up.
Do you know about that stare? You know, he learned it from, I want to say Robert Friedland, but it wasn't. It was, there was another guy that you, very charismatic fella, I got to go get the book, that you might remember. Could somebody bring me the Isaacson book?
Sitting on my desk right over
there. Sarah Lane's going to
run. Well, but yes, what
did he practice a stare on you? Unblinking?
No, but here's the true story is Steve and I were in the Reed College coffee shop one day, and I think it was his idea first to bring up the topic. The topic was, when you look at somebody, there's four different things going on simultaneously, okay? Because there's your right eye. If you realize that the left eye connects to the right brain and the right eye connects to the left brain, and the left and the right brain have different jobs to do,
right?
Okay? So left eye to left eye to right eye, right eye to right eye, right eye to left eye, there's different communications happening in those four things. And Steve and I used to practice that on each other. That was 1970.
Yeah, when you say practice it, trying to figure out what's going on?
Oh, just like seeing if you could tell what the difference was.
Uh-huh.
Because...
It was Robert Friedland, he says, that the...
Well, maybe Steve got it from Robert. Okay.
Now, everyone in the chat room is doing this right now.
Steve...
You know, everybody in the audience is like looking at somebody like, I got to figure this out too.
Well...
Steve says one of Friedland's numbers was to stare at the person he was talking to. He would stare into their effing eyeballs, ask some questions, and would want a response without the other person averting their eyes.
That's interesting.
Friedland, of course.
See, I never heard that.
Quite a character, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I recently reconnected with Robert.
Did you?
And
he's like a gold miner now, right?
He's been a gold miner for 40 years.
Yeah. Literally.
And he's done very well at it. And he's a billionaire with Ivanhoe Mines and doesn't have the most sterling reputation. But, you know, I guarantee you, if you meet him in person, you would be impressed and succed into his reality distortion field.
Mm. They say that might be where Jobs learned it.
I am sure.
Interesting.
Anyway, that was the good story about the stare.
I'm going to have to try that.
So
left eye to left eye to right eye to left eye to right to left.
Good God. Careful.
I mean, this is a theory that's not worked out yet in my mind, but the thing is that...
Like many theories worked out in a college dining hall.
You got to think, so left brain is the analytical processing,
right.
And that is your right eye,
right.
Okay? So right eye to right eye... is a certain type of communication, but left eye to left eye, that's the right brain, which is the artist and the nonlinear thinker.
Makes sense.
Right. So it's a different type of communication.
Although they say that a lot of that stuff is not as cut and dried as we'd like to think of it, that tasks are shared across the brain. But
and I'm dubious too. But anyway, it seemed like an interesting...
But there's definitely something, different about the two sides of the face and the two eyes.
Yes.
Says in this book that when the iPad went on sale, you went to the Apple store in Palo Alto.
Yes.
Because you wanted to be there and you wanted to see Steve.
No, I had no idea he was there.
Oh, you didn't know?
No.
You just wanted to participate in the excitement.
Well, it was my birthday.
Oh, yeah?
And I had been waiting for an iPad for years, really, because I play songs at the piano and I have all my lyric. I, you know, my rule is one page, one page per song. So I put all the lyrics and chords on one page. And I had bought a HP tablet, and it was too clunky, and I wasn't happy with it. And I was looking forward to putting my song lyrics on the iPad. So I was there the opening day and had already bought it, finished swiping the card, was ready to leave, and Steve walked by. And I just grabbed him, and it was an amazing moment. And
did he recognize you immediately?
Yeah, sure. And I remember thinking, I hadn't really talked to him in over 15 years.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, wow, Steve looks just like his photos.
Easy funny. To spot, huh?
Anyway, we had a nice chat.
What'd you talk about?
Oh, not much, really. Music. You know, he thought I was interested in sheet music on the iPad, which I'm not. And as it turns out, it was actually very difficult to get my lyrics until I found Goodreader.
Oh, Goodreader? Wonderful, yeah.
Well, you know, I have 800 Word documents, and I wanted to just alphabetize them, but no, can't do that on the iPad.
That's not the way it was made.
So, that's right.
You don't want to do that.
So, anyway. What else are you up? Let's come on. I want the Daniel Kaki story. But first of all, did you get any money out of Apple, out of that IPO at all?
Well, no, actually. So the full that's truth sad. Story was within like a, it was a month before the IPO. I finally screwed up my courage and I went to see Mike Markela, who was chairman of the board,
right.
And I said, Mike,
please.
You know, please,
hand
something.
Over a little bit.
And he wrote me an option for 1,000 shares, but at that point, it was 1,000 shares at $15, and it was the same 1,000 shares that went public at $20.
Right.
So that was essentially like a $20,000 bonus,
right.
And so I did get a bonus.
Right.
And in those days,
not a millionaire out of that.
In those days, you had to pay the tax up front just to exercise an option.
That's right.
And in those days, the tax rate was 33% or something. Oh. So you lost a third of your option immediately in the withholding tax.
Before you could even exercise.
So I got a bonus from Apple. That's what I got.
Yeah.
And then, but the only reason I was ever able to buy a house is because years later, Woz gave me some stock.
That's nice.
And it was small. It was a modest, it was 1,000 shares or 1,500 shares or something, but I was very frugal and did not take the advice of my accountant to sell it year after year after year.
Smart.
You know, the advice is diversify your portfolio, right?
And that's
and I
standard.
Didn't. And so actually now I'm very grateful to both Woz and Jobs that I have some
little something.
Something.
Did you ever become that engineer?
Which engineer?
You wanted to be an engineer, and Apple wasn't going to give you the option.
I did. Well, Steve did hire me as an engineer on the Mac project, and I was very grateful for that.
That's cool. So you're part of the Mac team.
I was, and it was an honor.
That must have been an experience.
It was a great experience, and I was always a little bit behind the curve.
Yeah. Well, you have Andy Hertzfeld. You have Bill Atkins.
Yeah, they were all superstars.
You have these brilliant guys doing amazing stuff.
I got the job of trying to share an office with Burl Smith, who was also our age,
right?
And brilliant, and a workaholic. He was a lot like Woz. He was very, very intense and would work through the
he
night.
He was also a technician who became an engineer.
Yes, that's
he
right.
He started similar to you, assembly and fixing stuff.
And he didn't have an Apple stock option either. Yeah. Although I would expect he got a big bonus
for the Mac.
For the Mac, yes.
But you were engineers at that point.
Yes, we were both engineers. But when I was made an engineer, I was not offered a stock option.
So what did you do on the Mac?
Well, I started out building prototypes. When the Mac project got funded by Steve, there was one prototype, one wire app prototype. That was it. And so to the extent that we were happy enough with that design, I immediately started building about another five or six.
Wire wrapping.
Wire app.
Wow.
You could build one in a week.
Wow.
From scratch. In fact, it got faster, you know.
Sure.
And then those wire app prototypes were constantly being rewired. So pretty much the whole first year was just building and maintaining those things. And then later that first year, we went to a PC board, and I was the one who brought up the PC boards. Burrell was the main architect, so he was responsible for the schematics and the equations for the programmable logic. That was the core of the design. The Mac used half a dozen
pals,
yeah. Right? And which was great. That was a whole new step forward in technology.
You didn't have to wire wrap those.
That's right.
Plug them in.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I was the person who was burning pals a lot.
Wow.
And then by the second year, Ed Riddle had come to get started on the keyboard project, and then he left, and so I took over the keyboard project, and that was my main job for the next 2 years, because that was a whole subsystem. It was both the keyboard and the keypad, and daisy-chained, and...
Do you still have a Mac in your closet somewhere?
Oh, I've got...
I mean, original Mac.
I've got probably five or six of them.
Really?
Including Apple IIs and Apple IIIs.
Apple IIs, too.
And,
yeah. You have a museum. You got to set up
a
museum.
I do. Well, because I was a self-taught engineer, so I had to hold on to all that stuff because that's how I learned.
Right.
Anyway, so I got to work with Burrell, which was a privilege and a challenge, a huge challenge, actually.
He eventually had severe mental issues.
And, yes. Yes.
That's a very sad story.
It is a sad story. Yeah. And, you know, Andy's still real estate partners with Burrell.
Yeah.
I used to see Burrell on the sidewalk a lot because I only live a few blocks from him, and he would go on long walks. I haven't seen him all year.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess if he stays medicated, then...
He's schizophrenic,
and pretty severely.
Yeah.
And, on a good day when he's medicated, he's still paranoid.
Yeah.
Okay, so you still can't have, like,
wow.
a conversation.
Yeah.
When he's bad, that's... you can get... Well, he was institutionalized.
Right. He actually threw a brick, I think, through
yes,
Steve's window.
Yes, at a church altar.
Yeah.
Altar, you know, the devil.
Right.
Mm. The devil was involved.
It's a very sad
story.
Yeah. Because he was brilliant.
He was brilliant,
engineer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
I suppose still is, really. It just
that's
has some,
right.
Has
locked
some
in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, Andy's a really warm-hearted guy.
One of the Andy Hertzfeld, one of the most...
Yeah.
Again, you, Andy, was that these just really sweet people... Who are just lovable.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's kind of neat. It's reassuring to me.
Yes.
Because that's the old hippie ethic that continued through. And,
yes.
And I just, I every time I talk to Andy, he's just such a happy-go-lucky,
yeah.
enthusiastic guy. Yeah.
And Bill Atkinson, too.
Bill, too.
Well,
great photographer, too.
Yes.
Bill's stuff is amazing.
Yes.
That's, I guess, mostly what he's doing now. Is a
yes.
photography.
Yes.
Yeah.
So tonight at the Tech Museum in San Jose, mm-hmm. there's a Churchill Club event with Bill Atkinson, Andy Hertzfeld, Larry Tesler, Regis McKenna.
Wow.
I want to go. That sounds incredible.
I am going. That's why I'm booking out of here.
All right, we're going to let you go. That's incredible. I hope they tape it and let us see it at some point.
I don't. That's a good question.
Yeah, Tesler, of course, one of the original Apple fellows.
He was
I
an
think.
Apple fellow.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
He was one of the Xerox
right, Park
people.
Guys. He showed yes. Steve Jobs
yes.
the Xerox Park stuff. In
yes.
fact, I've talked to Larry
in
about
fact,
that meeting. That
it was Larry and Bill Atkinson were the routines for the window and mouse
right.
interface on the
Brilliant.
Lisa and the Mac.
And of course, Regis McKenna, the PR guy, who put
yes.
Apple on the map.
Yes.
Taught Steve everything he knew about public relations.
And yes. marketing. And I, Andy Cunningham, I saw last, she came to the Mac reunion. I told Andy the story that it was one day in 1976, Steve and I were at the kitchen table in his parents' kitchen looking through Interface Age magazine when Steve was thinking about ads for the Apple One and trying to decide what he wanted in the flavor. A look of an ad, and the ad that he liked the most was an Intel ad, and it was very high tech, and it was like a flow chart with colored boxes with pipelines, right? And that was how Steve got referred to Regis McKenna, because he found out that Regis had done that ad.
Intel didn't want to tell him for a long time. He had
possibly.
He had a. Yes. They tell the story in the
I
book.
I see, okay.
Isaacson said he had a hammer at the door. They did not want to give up that name.
That's funny. Yes.
I wish we had more time with you, Daniel, but we do want to let you go to that Churchill Club event. That sounds
yes.
incredible.
So, let's see. What am
what
I doing now?
What else are you doing?
Yes, yes.
Well, I actually have like half a dozen hardware projects, of which the closest to production I actually have a product for sale. It's called Das Blinken Lights. And it's twinkling LEDs, which I did 8 years ago, and that was to build rapport with the factory in China. Uh-huh. So I got a contact for a good factory in Shenzhen, and I didn't trust him to build a computer.
So we'll do something simple.
So yeah. We had this LED thing.
I think ThinkGeek was selling those for a while, weren't they? That's blinking lights.
That sounds really familiar.
ThinkGeek sold our Tix clock, which was the other project I did. And then the next one that I'm working on, it's called ScrollBot. It was called MessagePod until Apple sued me over the trademark.
Oh my God, it's endless.
And I could have said, go ahead and sue me, but I wasn't close enough to be on the market. But it's a, I don't have a patent application, but it's a scrolling message display that is intended to connect to Facebook and Twitter.
Okay.
We have one. You know, an MIT student sent me something.
You could make one out of an Arduino.
It's pretty straightforward.
Yes.
Although, I don't know if we ever got it working. And then we were going to put it up here and let people, it would watch for hashtags. Then we thought, oh, that's going to be a problem. We are live after all. Yes. Well, good. We'll watch. I'll use yours when it comes out. Yes. That's great. What's it going to be called again?
It's called the ScrollBot.
The ScrollBot.
And I'm on my third revision of the PC board, and I've just added Wi-Fi to it, so it's a wireless device now. And it's way too much for me to do myself, but the case is done, and much of it's already done. The layout's done.
I love it that you're still designing products.
Well, I hope to actually make money someday. I kind of feel like at this stage in my life, I don't have time for these hobbies. Anyway, so I bought this resort project last year, the old Maharishi University up near Harbin. Mm-hmm. And what the challenge about that I like is the card key systems, the solar hot tub system, the power monitoring. So we have 75 cabins. They all need power monitoring.
I can promise when you open, I will be there every year.
It's going to be a hacker colony.
That sounds wonderful. John Draper will
be there hosting a little hacker conference.
That sounds wonderful.
So that's actually my main project right now. And then I have an Eco Village project in East Palo Alto, which is what I started doing in 2009. And that's been stalled for lack of funding. But it's starting to move forward again now. So I just have a big vacant lot, and I'm planning to build four houses and make a little eco village.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. That's my retirement plan.
That sounds good to me. Yeah. Let me know if you need a roommate. Daniel Kottke, the website to go to for the next step is, put it up there, tns-cableshow.blogspot.com.
That's correct.
And people can watch it if you're in the peninsula area on cable access. Five times every day it's on.
Every day.
Almost.
Five times a week on Channel 27.
Channel 27. And they could watch it on the internet.
And it's webcast in QuickTime. Whenever, so Wednesday night, 11 to 12.
And is it the Channel 27 website?
Yeah, you go to midpenmedia.org.
Midpenmedia.org. Okay.
And say, watch now, Channel 27.
Got it.
And it streams and comes up in QuickTime.
What time?
Wednesday nights, 11 to 12.
Pacific.
Sunday nights, 10 to 11.
Hey, okay. You're on the front page right now.
Good.
And the show that's airing this month is an hour-long interview with John Draper.
Great.
Talking about Blue Boxes and the first collaboration between Woz and Jobs. It was a very nice interview. I was glad to have John.
Yeah. I think he mentioned you as well when we talked to him. He's a fan.
Yeah.
Daniel, great to see you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to meet you, Daniel.
I can reach over there. And we thank you all for doing Triangulation with us every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. 2400, I guess it's the stroke of midnight UTC on twit.tv. If you've missed the show, though, we have downloads for you. Don't have high def yet. We did our first high def download of Twit on Sunday, and it looks gorgeous, 720p, because we do shoot this show at 720p. It's just nobody gets to see it unless you're here in the studio. And we are going to do more of those downloads. The only issue on that is they're big, 1.6 gigabytes. of MPEG-4, H.264. But it looks gorgeous. So I don't know what we're going to do. We may end up putting together a BitTorrent server just for the high def, because the bandwidth, cash flow will kill us if we put all our shows out at 720p. Soon, though, watch for it.
Or we can just charge $1,000 for the first one.
There you go. And then we won't have to think about it ever again.
Then they can just take it and put it out.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Tom Merritt. Thank you, Daniel Kaki. Great to see you.
Thank you, Leo.
Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.